Like, duh. Yeah, well, that's because they weren't sent. They were disallowed going, right? There was no instant rebuttal there. NPR, who I listened to it through, though I recommend listening it through KPFA, because that's where I get the Mitch Jesuits interviews that I'm going to be presenting. The other thing was the common sense argument that the Ukrainian new administration didn't bring up the lack of aid being delivered, military aid. The U.S. aid is mainly military. The overwhelming amount of the European participation is non-military aid, and it's huge, contrary to the burden-sharing argument that Trump makes. But those little details get lost in the shuffle, too. I got Mel Goodman on Ukraine. He's not quite as vociferous as the other ex-CIA guy I go to, who better check in with Roy McGovern. I'm sure he's pulling his hair out over this. He was a Soviet analyst, briefed the president. I don't know, Mel Goodman wrote a whistleblower expose of his leaving the CIA. He was leaving over the faking of Soviet strength during the CIA tenure of George Herbert Walker Bush. He had some tanglings with SAIC's occasional CEO, SAIC, a local firm in town. Actually, they're multinational. On the down low, there's still nothing really been written. Well, Spies for Hire by Tim Shorrock. Here I am extemporizing again. I got a sobering thing about the doomsday clock being put to 100 seconds. I don't know if it's ever been closer than that. Maybe it has. It sounds pretty scary to me. The dual problems of no restraints on nuclear weaponry as the treaties are being disavowed and et cetera, and climate change. They introduced that in the last few years. It's just a short little essay, but it's sobering, it seems to me. And that's a good thing. Be a little sober here on Saturday morning. But the other point that jumped out at me was this common sense argument that the Ukrainians didn't say anything about the lack of material aid weaponry that they weren't getting until a political article was released. And then they were all over it. It's like that means that they didn't know they weren't receiving military aid. They had to rely on a political article to tell them that they, maybe the State Department under Trump might be that incompetent, but obviously they know they're not receiving the aid. They may just not have known how to approach the Trump administration to find out what was going on is a better surmise, it seems to me. So I haven't heard anybody on the Democratic side make that argument. So, but they do avoid characterizing the reaction by the Ukrainians. They're obviously in a very submissive position to the hyperpower. All right, Mumia has something to say about the Senate trial. He's pretty much of a skeptic. I have alternately skeptical and positive views of some attempt to bring justice. And I learned a lot. I didn't know George Washington, actually, his opinions about impeachment and the hearing and the power of the parliament, they might have called it that in those days, power of the Congress to get material. So, but there actually are quotes that were marshaled by one of the presenters about it. A long history lesson. So there were some good things about listening to it in the background, it seems. I don't remember exactly what Mumia's take is, but he's pretty skeptical. And Aaron Maté, I've got. He's a pretty controversial guy. He is now working with Ben Norton and Max Blumenthal of Gray Zone, doing their video production, it seems. Pretty dissident view. Haven't played anything from Moderate Rebels. That's the name of the podcast. I'll just pitch it in that sense. Taking the name from the big lie about what was going on in Syria, it seems to me. I think they have some good basis for their dissidents and even their attacks on The Intercept, actually, frankly. But it gets all very complicated. But something about being in prison and watching this stuff might clarify Mumia's perspective, it seems. Amy Goodman's got something on something completely different that's going on that we're not getting much news on. The trials in Gitmo. Maybe there's a calculated thing to have the descriptions of torture being covered by the impeachment hearings. Are they that clever? I'm not sure.
Senate trial. Question. When is a trial not a trial? Answer. When it's a Senate trial. After days of opening remarks and statements from the so-called trial of the President of the United States, the question of witnesses remains undecided. The institution's majority leader, Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, has his lead foot on the gas, pedaling his way to a predetermined destination, Acquittal Town. And guess what? The car is still speeding down the road. Will anything change the route? I don't think so. For politicians don't really care about principles. They care about power. And Trump, his finger just inches away from his send button, holds his party like a wolf holds chickens. They don't dare cross it. Will they stand against him? Again, I don't think so. A few months ago, I warned of a triumphant Trump. I still think that is the case, but we shall see. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Amy on Gitmo momentarily. I think I kind of trailed off about the rally in March and mentioned also last week the Women's March on campus was going to be the same time, but they've moved it actually to tomorrow between 1 p.m. and 2:30. I don't know what went into that decision, but I'm glad they're not coincidence, so one could possibly go to both for a piece of time. That's on campus, so you can't drive by and blow your horn like you might be able to in downtown Urbana. Again, this 1 o'clock, the steps of the old post office, IMC, little walk around downtown Urbana, federal courthouse, county seat, all that good stuff. And let's see, no real salience on the 1 to 2:30 Women's March that I can pull out of here. But that's happening. So back to Gitmo with Amy Goodman. And thanks for tuning in. And maybe you have the Squawk Box on the other channel in the background or the pictures to make sure you're not missing something. Well, like I said, I got David Swanson making his argument about why he's missing it all. And I respect his decision.
The Tropic of Torture, from Guantanamo to Washington. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. All eyes are on the U.S. Senate this week for the impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump, only the third presidential impeachment trial in U.S. history. But another important trial is happening at the same time, far from the eyes of the public, at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Behind the razor wire fencing of what's called Camp Justice, five of the remaining 41 Guantanamo prisoners sit through more pretrial hearings, almost 20 years after the September 11, 2001 attacks they're charged with perpetrating. One witness this week is Dr. James Mitchell, a retired Air Force psychologist who, with his partner, psychologist John Bruce Jessen, developed and implemented the CIA's post-9/11 torture program. Mitchell and Jessen actively participated in torture sessions at CIA black sites. Both have long maintained they were only contractors taking orders from the CIA. Despite having no prior experience with interrogation, they were paid handsomely, receiving at least $81 million in taxpayer dollars from the U.S. government for their work on the torture program. Torture is a war crime, and those who torture should be prosecuted. But Mitchell is not the one on trial this week. Indeed, he defiantly said in court, "I'd get up today and do it again." Dr. Mitchell was sitting in the courtroom not far from his torture victims. The pretrial hearings at Guantanamo this week are an attempt by the defense attorneys for the five, all who face the death penalty, to suppress statements the defendants made to the FBI during or not long after being tortured by the CIA. Among the five prisoners is the alleged 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times, some or all of which were directly conducted by Dr. Mitchell. Waterboarding is a torture technique that uses water and a wet towel over one's mouth and nose to bring a victim to the brink of suffocation, simulating drowning. Doctors Mitchell and Jessen shun the word torture, preferring the euphemism enhanced interrogation techniques, or EITs. The American Civil Liberties Union sued Drs. Mitchell and Jessen on behalf of two CIA prisoners and the family of another CIA torture victim, Ghul Rahman, who died during his brutal interrogation and torture at a CIA black site in Afghanistan. In the lawsuit, the ACLU summarized some of these enhanced interrogation techniques. They write, "Torture methods devised by Mitchell and Jessen and inflicted on three men include slamming them into walls, stuffing them inside coffin-like boxes, exposing them to extreme temperatures and ear-splitting levels of music, starving them, inflicting various kinds of water torture, depriving them of sleep for days, and chaining them in stress positions designed for pain and to keep them awake for days on end," end quote. Mitchell and Jessen said they reverse-engineered techniques taught to the U.S. military to avoid capture or, if caught, how to resist torture and interrogation. The military training is called SERE, or S-E-R-E, for survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. In theory, SERE was developed to help people survive. Mitchell and Jessen developed techniques to harm people, not to help them. That vital distinction raised ethical concerns with members of the American Psychological Association, the APA, concerns that were dismissed by the organization's leadership eager to please the administration of President George W. Bush. Anti-torture psychologists led a multi-year campaign challenging the collusion of the APA, the world's largest professional association of psychologists, with the Pentagon and the CIA. The APA leadership was ultimately ousted, and the organization barred its members from participating in harsh interrogations. While he was campaigning for the Republican presidential nomination in 2015 and 16, Donald Trump frequently touted the need for torture, even though torture is almost universally acknowledged to deliver false or unreliable information.
"I would bring back waterboarding, and I'd bring back a hell of a lot worse than waterboarding,"
Trump bragged at one of the candidate debates. Speaking on the Democracy News Hour, Bahar Azmi, legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights, a nonprofit law group that's represented scores of Guantanamo prisoners, reflected on the impeachment trial of Donald Trump and the Guantanamo military tribunals.
"They are, in a sense, both show trials. The military commissions process was generated instead of a traditional, you know, Article III criminal trial in order to suppress the truth, as is the Senate version of the trial, in order to repress accountability for war crimes, and in the Senate trial, repress accountability for an abuse of power."
This week, the tortured logic of the U.S. system of justice is on full display from Washington, D.C. to Guantanamo Bay. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, that's a pretty great comparison. Well, this is kind of an FIY announcement. I thought this was on a calendar in error, but there's another MLK celebration just kicked off 15 minutes ago, so I guess you can't really go. But I seem to be put on partially by the College of Education at the U of I. Keynote speaker is Chicago native sophomore Hannah Glass, who works with a group in Chicagoland called Health of the Homeless. I believe it operates in Chicago, though she's here quite a bit too. There's a choir, as is appropriate for MLK Day, but that's going on too. So maybe some people are doing that instead of listening to the Republican defense. Well, we are going to hear some stuff from Pacifica's coverage of the impeachment trial. The great Marjorie Cohn, who was on Democracy Now!, I commend your attention. She's also quite skeptical of anything going anywhere, but does make the legal arguments, and we're going to hear one of them about the basis for this obstruction of Congress argument that we've heard various assessments of, and I'm sure that'll be highlighted. Got to watch Sekulow, too, because he has a tendency to get in a frenzy and provide some comedic moments, if there are any. All right. This is a short clip, though, I mentioned earlier from Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, a little short video or press release they did about their moving the doomsday clock setting up to 100 seconds before midnight. And I'll just turn it over to them. I ran into some people who thought this would be a good thing to bring forward, and as part of the discussion in the section with the ex-CIA guy that I've got coming up is about Ukraine and geopolitics in a perspective that I haven't heard anywhere. I'm going to get to that for sure. But here's a short two-minute brief press release statement from Chicago-based, I think, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. If anything's based in any one locale anymore, I guess.
It is 2 minutes to midnight. To call the world's nuclear situation dire is to understate the danger and its immediacy. We consider the ossified state of arms control negotiations and non-proliferation agreements, as well as new testing undertaken by North Korea, nuclear exercises built into Russia's military plans, and an enhanced commitment to nuclear weapons in Pakistan, India, and China. We considered at length the lack of predictability in how the United States is thinking about the future and future use of its own nuclear weapons, an unpredictability that it is embodied in statements and tweets by the President of the United States.
Today, the danger of some sort of nuclear catastrophe is greater than it was during the Cold War, and most people are blissfully unaware of this danger. The Bolton's clock now stands at 2 minutes to midnight, which I want to emphasize is as close as it has ever been to midnight in the 71-year history of the clock. The danger of nuclear conflagration is not the only reason the clock has been moved forward, as my colleagues have described. This danger looms at a time when there's been a loss of trust in political institutions, in the media, in science, and in facts themselves, all of which exacerbate the difficulty of dealing with the real problems the world faces, and which threaten to undermine the ability of governments to effectively deal with these problems.
While the main impetus for this year's forward movement of the clock was the perilous nuclear situation, climate change very much remains a serious and worsening threat. 2017 did not yield encouraging progress. After having plateaued for a few years, global greenhouse gas emissions resumed their stubborn rise. Here in the U.S., the incoming President Trump promptly appointed a cadre of avowed climate denialists to top positions and quickly started reversing existing climate measures. And of course, he also formally declared his intention to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. In other words, the U.S. President has done his best to follow through on his stated intention of derailing U.S. climate action.
We present the clock not so much as doom and gloom, but as an opportunity to get government and the public discussing the important issues, and we provide, we hope, a forum for that to be carried out intelligently and eventually be adopted as public policy.
And that ain't no Chicken Little. That's, again, a video statement on their pretty much obscured press release about... closer than it's ever been. I guess it's been at 2 minutes before, but they decided to make it 100 seconds to midnight to emphasize the severity of the instance. Well, I guess maybe we're a little in the process about the impeachment here with the great Marjorie Cohn. That's spelled C-O-H-N, and Marjorie is with an I-E. You can go right to her website. She gets picked up on Pacifica a fair amount. She gets in Truth Out, some other media, but she's always good at for her articles on her own website, which I'm going to look at while we're listening to this short interview that was recorded yesterday morning, right before the session started. And Mitch Jezerich is holding it down. Again, she was on Democracy Now, not talking exactly about the same subject, so bring her insights to you now.
Final day of the House Democratic floor manager's oral arguments. Today, we anticipate the floor managers to make the case for the second article of impeachment, which is obstruction of Congress. President Trump's defense team is scheduled to begin their arguments tomorrow. Next week will be a critical moment in this trial, as senators will have 16 hours for questions in which the floor managers and the defense team may be able to actually rebut one another. And then the votes as to whether to have witnesses and to allow for the admission of additional evidence into the trial. As we wait for the trial to begin, again, we're joined on the telephone by Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, author of the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, we always are greatly appreciative of you taking time to join us.
Well, thanks for having me, Mitch. I appreciate that.
Marjorie, what is obstruction of Congress?
Obstruction of Congress is interfering with Congress's constitutional duty to have the power over all impeachments. The Constitution says that the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. That means that the president doesn't get to censor what Congress does. And by stonewalling the proceedings in the House during the impeachment inquiry, the president violated, basically, you know, thumbed his nose at the separation of powers, at the Constitution's clear command that the House of Representatives has the sole power of impeachment. So he refused to allow any document, he didn't produce one document, he refused to allow all executive branch employees from testifying, and he said that they would enjoy absolute immunity from civil and criminal liability. Now, absolute immunity is a doctrine that no court has upheld. In fact, recently in the McGahn case, a court struck it down and said that a president is not king, and he doesn't have control over, over everything, over everyone. Now, Trump's lawyers will talk a lot about, when it's their turn to rebut Article 2, they'll talk a lot about executive privilege and how forcing witnesses to testify and documents to be turned over would violate executive privilege, and that's going to hurt future presidents. Actually, Trump has not asserted executive privilege at all. He just says they shouldn't testify, period. Executive privilege is invoked for certain internal executive branch communications and may or may not be sustained by, I guess, the Chief Justice will make that ruling, although 51 senators can overrule him. But the witness is testifying, and the witness is asked a question, and then the defense lawyers for Donald Trump will say, objection, that calls for an answer that's protected by executive privilege, and then there will be a ruling on whether the witness has to answer that. But he hasn't asserted executive privilege. He has just completely stonewalled. And he's also making that same argument, his lawyers, to prevent the Senate from calling witnesses and subpoenaing documents. Now, they've already had pretrial motions where the House managers, the prosecutors, tried to amend the Senate rules that Mitch McConnell had come up with to allow four witnesses to testify, to allow the subpoena of four witnesses, including Mick Mulvaney, acting chief of staff, who actually admitted there was a quid pro quo, a this for that, a dirt for dollars, however you want to say it, and John Bolton, the former national security advisor to Trump, who left on very uncomfortable terms. And Trump has already indicated that he will assert executive privilege to Bolton's testimony. He's very worried about it. He says Bolton knows all of my thoughts on these issues, and so it's a threat to national security. And he said that Bolton left on less than positive terms, and he's really, really afraid of what Bolton would say. And then the other subpoenas that were tabled by, on a strict party line vote, the Republicans voting to table the issue of witnesses and the issue of production of documents, the subpoenaing of documents from the White House, the Pentagon, the Office of Management and Budget, etc. And by tabling the issue of whether the Senate will hear witnesses or force the administration to turn over these documents, what they're doing is kind of an Alice in Wonderland type of thing, where first the trial, then the evidence. So there's going to be 6 days of opening statements, three from the managers. This is today's the third day of their opening statements, three from the defense. Then 16 hours of the senators questioning, asking questions. And then they may turn to the issue of whether witnesses can be subpoenaed or documents produced. They may or may not. It's not clear whether these, they need a 51 votes, and some senators, kind of moderate senators like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Mitch Romney have made noises that they may vote to hear witnesses, although I'll believe it when I see it. So that may or may not come to the floor. McConnell wants to rush this through. He wants to get it over with. He wants to have an acquittal in hand that Trump can brag about during his State of the Union address on February 4th. And initially, McConnell wanted each side to present its 24 hours of opening statements in 2 days, which would have made for 12-hour days, which would have made them go from 1 p.m. Eastern to 1 a.m. in the morning. And he finally gave on that. I think some of the moderate Republicans said, "Wait a minute, this is just too much."
Or it was just sort of a calculated thing that he could give way on, make it look like he was flexible. I don't know. I've heard that a fair amount. That's Marjorie Cohn, and that line, "First the trial, then the evidence, impeachment in Wonderland," that's the title of her article. If you want to see some more of her ideas. I do want to get this Melvin Goodman section on, even though I'm wondering about him. He's a open... he's a whistleblower with the CIA, so problematic in some ways. But his brief was Eastern Europe, and then the things that he has to say about the Ukraine and the whole way this geopolitical chess game is going on is sobering and also insightful. So I think this might have a little bit of time for David Swanson, the guy that's not listening. He makes a call out about the what's being pushed off the front page. He said that the pipeline was authorized this week, and I certainly didn't hear anything about that. That's the one that is going to go through native territory and was never supposed to leak in the sections that they have put in already, as we know, leaked. But here's Aaron Maté. He's a critic. I think there's a nuanced interplay between he and Mitch Jeserich that I think is well worth your attention. And then Mel Goodman talking about his reactions to the third day of the trial. Was it second day? They blur together. All right. Again, there's a rally today at 1 o'clock at the... starting out, I guess it's a march kind of rally. Maybe that'll be, depending on how icy the sidewalks are, maybe there'll be a gathering inside at the IMC, where a group sponsoring locally, Answer Coalition. Again, Answer Coalition San Francisco is going to be broadcast on KPFA, so if you want to involve and be a stay-in person today, which I can empathize with, there is that, kpfa.org.
That's a little over 2 hours down, a little under 22 hours still available to the seven House floor managers will have between now and the end of Friday to make their case for the removal of President Trump from office. Now, on Saturday, President Trump's defense team will begin to make their case for acquittal, and they will have 24 hours or until the end of Tuesday to make their case. I'm Mitch Jeserich coming to you from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. Now, Adam Schiff took the past little over 2 hours to lay out the allegation that President Donald Trump abused his office by withholding military aid to Ukraine in order to force Ukraine to announce investigations into both Hunter and Joe Biden. Adam Schiff relied heavily on a national security argument, even saying that the United States was backing Ukraine and it was in the United States' interest to back Ukraine in order to fight Russia over there or in Eastern Europe rather than here. There is no doubt that this will bother many of those who are critical of U.S. involvement around the world. And we're going to talk more in just a moment about that dynamic with journalist Aaron Maté. But first, I want to let you know that broadcasts like this are solely possible because of you and listeners like you who believe in financially supporting their public radio station. Now, we had not budgeted to be able to bring you the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. So instead, what we're doing is this is our model and this is how we do it. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time doing it. I'm just sort of passing the hat around, recognizing many of you have already donated at the end of the year, and we're very appreciative of that. But if you haven't donated and want to help us be able to continue to bring you broadcasts around the Senate impeachment trial, this going to pass the hat around right now and ask to throw whatever exposable income that you have to make that possible. Now, for listeners to KPFA, KPFB, KFCF, and our listeners in Santa Cruz, the phone number you're going to call to make that donation is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And for our listeners in Southern California, the phone number to make that contribution is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 or online at kpfk.org. So donate what you can to help broadcasts like this possible. We are in about a 20-minute break. Usually these breaks last a little longer than they say, but not significantly so. So I suspect we're going to have about 20 to 30 minutes for analysis of the impeachment trial. And first, with analysis for today, is journalist Aaron Mate. Now, Aaron Mate writes for The Nation magazine. He has a television journalism show called The Gray Zone. He's also former host and producer for both The Real News and Democracy Now. Aaron Mate, it is my good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio station.
Thanks for having me again, Mitch.
It's good to have you, sir. So, Aaron, you are well known for the critical reporting and analysis that you have done on previously on the Robert Mueller investigation, also for critical analysis of the Democrats' attempts to impeach Donald Trump. But before we get to the heart of what your argument is, I do want to give you a chance, if you have been observing the Senate trial so far, to say whatever has stood out to you or what you're watching for or just your reaction to the trial so far.
Well, on the process question, I think it's unfortunate that Republicans are blocking witnesses, and I hope that that gets reversed. It looks like there's a chance that that might be a possibility to hear witnesses, and I think that should happen. There's no reason to not have a transparent process. But I also think that, as I thought from the start, that this whole thing is a really bad idea for the Democrats and for the prospects of defeating Trump in 2020. It's the same reason that I thought that the whole Russiagate obsession was a terrible idea too. For one, I don't think the evidence is there, although I think there's certainly more here to this Ukrainegate thing than there was to Russiagate. But also, it requires adopting, I think, a very dangerous, hawkish, Cold War national security mindset that you mentioned, Mitch, that I just don't think any progressive should be behind. You had Adam Schiff just now in his opening statement saying things like, we are providing this military assistance to Ukraine so that Ukraine can fight the Russians there so that we don't have to fight them here. I mean, which is just delusional Cold War chauvinism. It's not true. The U.S. is not stopping Russia from invading the United States by fighting Russia and Ukraine. What the U.S. is actually doing is waging a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine, a proxy war that we basically helped start going back to the coup in Ukraine in 2014 that the Obama administration waged. And to show just how transparently fallacious Schiff's argument is, if Trump is weakening our national security by briefly freezing military funding to Ukraine, then Obama would have to be what would have to have seriously hurt our national security even more, because Obama, I think very bravely and rightly, refused to send the military assistance because he didn't want to further inflame the proxy war that he started. And he also was worried about weapons falling into the hands of far-right neo-Nazis, which are a critical component, unfortunately, of the Ukrainian armed forces. So Adam Schiff is, according to the logic of his own argument, he's basically accusing Barack Obama of seriously endangering our national security. So it's just, to me, it's Cold War insanity, and it's on top of the fact that I think all of this ultimately helps Trump, because, again, Trump ran against the kind of Cold War jingoism that Hillary Clinton represented, and he won. And of course, in office, Trump has actually been a total hawk. He's been a militarist on all fronts. But instead of us challenging that, instead of us challenging things like his recent war crime against Iran, starting a war basically with Iran by killing its top leader, we're basically trying to challenge him for briefly not being hawkish enough towards Russia. So I just think it's a tragedy what we're witnessing. And I think as much as people think that this is a challenge to Trump, I think we have to be very careful from separating what our hopes are from what the reality is.
I just want to point out and acknowledge, but not necessarily debate, because I am not a specialist on Ukrainian and Russian relations, but there are those who will say, even if you acknowledge the U.S. role in the region between Ukraine and the United States, that it's more than just a proxy war. It is a struggle for Ukraine for their own sense of sovereignty. So I don't want to debate that. I just want to put that out there, because usually when I hear what you just say, Aaron Mate, I'll get the emails. I'm sure as you will understand.
I understand.
Yeah, and I think that I think there's a good point and reasons to be concerned hearing Adam Schiff say we are backing Ukraine so that we can fight Russia there rather than here. I don't think anyone can make a good argument that we would be fighting Russia here if it wasn't for what is happening in Ukraine. And I think you can make an argument whether or not it is prudent or is it appropriate to back Ukraine or not. I don't want to get into that argument as well. But for me, I guess I can also compartmentalize these issues and still look at the heart of what the impeachment attempt is about. Whether we accept or like this military aid to Ukraine is one thing. But what has also happened, these are public funds. We are paying it through our taxes. This is part of the United States. And that from these public funds, if we look at it that way, the president is using this in order to improve his own standing for his own personal gain. Even if we dislike what it's for, the fact that he is using this military aid as leverage in order, according to the allegation, to force Ukraine to just announce that they're going to do an investigation into a political rival, Joe Biden, and there's arguments about, you know, what Hunter Biden was doing there. I think those are valid too. But to use that in order to get this investigation, when you're not seeing Trump bring up a lot of other issues around corruption, does seem to be a very serious thing that I believe could be impeachable.
Well, where I'll disagree is, I guess, on whether this is worthy of an impeachment scandal, even if we put aside the hawkish Cold War mentality that I think is underlying this. Look, if you presume that all the allegations against Trump are correct, then okay, you have an argument. The problem is, I don't think Democrats have proved it. They didn't have a single witness who actually said that Trump directly linked the military funding to the opening of investigations. You had Gordon, but the closest you came was Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, saying that that was his presumption. But Gordon Sondland's presumption is just as valuable as the presumption of Kurt Volker, another U.S. official who said that he saw no linkage. And the other problem you have is you have a series of Ukrainian officials, all of whom say, and you know, maybe they're lying, but this is at least what they say. And unfortunately, you have to take their statement seriously if you're taking the standards of the court seriously. All of them say that they saw no linkage and that that they saw no quid pro quo. So if you're going to make that case, fine, but you have to prove it. And part of my critique here is that Democrats have not been able to prove it. There's not a single fact witness who said that Trump explicitly linked the military funding to an investigation. And there's no Ukrainian official who said that we saw such a linkage. That is a serious evidentiary hole that has to be overcome.
So let's look at then the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress. And the point being is that you have a blanketed attempt from, not just attempt, but basically statement and policy from the White House that they are not going to allow any of their people to testify in the impeachment inquiry, nor provide the documents that the House of Representatives has requested. So they haven't been able to get to those people who have been direct witnesses.
Yeah, and look, on this one, I see this as similar to the obstruction of justice claims against Trump during the Mueller investigation. It's a process issue. It's a process allegation that results from an investigation into the underlying charge. And if you can't prove the underlying charge, I'm just personally, I'm not going to get behind impeaching someone for a process issue. There's, you know, and to me, if I were in law school, if I was a professor, a legal scholar, I think it would be interesting. But, you know, I don't, like, even if Democrats have a case here on Trump obstructing justice on this issue, I just don't think it's compelling unless you can really prove that he's guilty, egregiously guilty of the underlying crime. And so, you know, you have someone like Jonathan Turley, he's a Democrat, but yet he testified that basically Trump was exercising his constitutional duty in fighting subpoenas, and that if Democrats didn't want to countenance that they could take him to court, which they chose not to do. And so, look, I don't have a particular position on that either way. I mean, maybe Democrats have a case here that Trump obstructed justice, but to me, it's just not very compelling. It's not worthy of impeachment if you can't establish convincingly that Trump is guilty of the underlying crime. And also, by the way, given that Trump is guilty of so many far worse offenses, are you going to tell me that Trump imposing murderous sanctions on Venezuela and Iran, and, you know, launching military strikes that kill a top Iranian and Iraqi official, or that kill civilians in Afghanistan and elsewhere, that all of that is less impeachable than Trump fighting congressional subpoenas? I mean, I just can't get behind that argument.
I'm sympathetic to what you say there, that there are other reasons, maybe even better reasons, one could argue, for impeaching Donald Trump. I guess the way I see it, and Aaron, I appreciate you entertaining me here with this. I guess the way that I see this is that that's what they had the votes for. They tried to impeach. There was a vote on articles of impeachment brought by Al Green, Democrat from Houston, just before Robert Mueller even testified to Congress. Got more votes than previous attempts in articles of impeachment over the years, ever since and after Bill Clinton's impeachment. But that said, they just didn't have the votes for them. This is what they had the votes for to move forward with this. And it kind of gets into the question, do we impeach or do we not impeach? And I'll even go back to the first presidential impeachment that we had in 1868 of Andrew Johnson. For 2 years, the radical Republicans were trying to impeach Andrew Johnson because of Andrew Johnson's willingness to allow the South not to do all the reforms that needed to happen for what, you know, the radical Republicans wanted to see even for racial equality after the Civil War in the South. And Thaddeus Stevens, who was the main guy trying to impeach Andrew Johnson, spent 2 years trying to do it. He was always successful, had many votes, was never able to get to the votes. It wasn't until Andrew Johnson actually violated this very obscure act known as the Tenure of Office Act, because he violated that act and senators wanted some illegal act in there. That's when Thaddeus Stevens finally had the votes to move forward on impeachment. But it wasn't really about the Tenure of Office Act. It was really about everything else. But that's what they had the votes for. And I guess that's how I see this Ukraine situation. That's actually what they have the votes for. I'll give you the final word.
I got that, but... Well, I got that, but to me, that's just not an argument for, you know, pursuing the most serious congressional remedy possible, which is voting to remove a president from office. If you don't have the votes for his far more serious offenses, to me, that's just not an argument for pursuing something that's relatively marginal, especially because it's not, you know, we can't just consider this, you know, on its own. It comes in a very real political context. We have to look at the consequences, the likely consequences of your actions. And, you know, if I'm an undecided voter, or if I'm a voter who didn't vote in 2016, but I'm considering voting in 2020. And I look at Democrats and what are they focused on? They've been focused for the first 3 years on a ridiculous conspiracy theory that Donald Trump conspired with or was controlled by the Kremlin. That was disproven and debunked. And that also brought endless attention on the emails of a Democratic candidate and, you know, apparent corruption by Democratic leaders, and we were mad that Russia allegedly stole these emails and that Trump might have conspired. And now what are they focused on again? It's another thing that also involves Russia, because the allegation is that Trump weakened our defense against Russia, never fighting them there, so we have to fight Russia here, and that he asked for an investigation that implicated another Democratic leader. So voters are looking at Democrats and seeing a party that is fighting over, first, a failed conspiracy theory, and both times, basically, because they don't like a spotlight that is being shined on the alleged corruption of their candidates, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. And to me, that's just not a very exciting or appealing message for the voters that have to be won over to beat Trump in 2020. Democrats are fighting harder to uphold the Empowerment Control Act, whatever it's called, than they are to fight for health care for everybody, or to fight Trump's tax cuts. You know, there were bigger protests over the firing of Jeff Sessions than there were over Trump breaking the Iran nuclear deal. So basically, liberals and prominent liberals have fought harder to defend Jeff Sessions' job security than they did to save the Iran nuclear deal. And the consequences of this have been a weak resistance that is not focused on Trump's biggest crimes, and also a resistance that is not focused on things that is going to win over the voters that need to be won over to beat Trump in 2020. So, you know, on the merits of it, I don't think it's very strong. And tactically, strategically, in terms of what can beat Trump in 2020, I think it's harmful.
Aaron Mate is the host of the program The Gray Zone. He is a journalist who also writes for The Nation magazine. Aaron Mate, I do thank you for taking time to chat with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. Currently, we are in a break. The Democrats have used about just over 2 hours of their 24 hours available that they have to use over 3 days to make their oral arguments in favor of removing President Trump from office. Trump's defense team will begin to make its oral arguments on Saturday. Well, now let's move to another guest, Melvin A. Goodman. Melvin A. Goodman is a national security and intelligence expert. He directs the National Security Project at the Center for International Policy and is adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, author of the book Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. Mel Goodman is a former CIA officer who focused on Eastern Europe. Mel Goodman, good to have you back, sir.
Thank you, Mitch. Good to be with you.
Really wanted to bring you in, as we also did with Aaron Mate, who's been somewhat of a critic, but also wanted of the impeachment, in part because of the situation and just sort of the hawkish stand that the United States traditionally has in Eastern Europe, in this part of the world. And also wanted to bring you in because, again, we heard a lot of the national security talk and argument from Adam Schiff in his 2.5 hours of the oral arguments. What is your take when we talk about, and this is something you've specialized over the years, when we talk about national security in Eastern Europe?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that the events that have taken place in Ukraine that deal with the politics of the Trump administration have led to this adoption of Ukraine as a strategic ally. I'm very concerned about that. And so Adam Schiff, who's rather conservative on national security matters to begin with, has joined this chorus of witnesses, including the State Department witnesses, who talked about Ukraine as a strategic ally. In the case of George Kent, one of the highest-ranking officers of the Department of State, talked about Ukraine as a future member of NATO. So if you want to make sure that there's going to be a renewal of the Cold War, just go down this road of making Ukraine a strategic ally and bring them into NATO, and there will never be any opportunity for improving relations between Russia and the United States. But I find that conversation that deals with national security obscures exactly what Trump has done in terms of compromising the integrity of the office of the presidency and compromising the integrity and the foundation of American democracy. And that's what we shouldn't lose sight of. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that he invited Russian interference, or sort of maybe legitimized Russian interference in the 2016 election. And now he has lobbied Ukraine and put pressure on Ukraine, and particularly Zelensky himself, by inviting Ukraine to have a role in the 2020 election. And this is the key issue. That's why we're dealing with impeachment. We're not dealing with impeachment because of national security issues or Ukraine is a foreign policy problem. We're dealing with impeachment because of Trump's compromising of American values and American democracy. And that's where I think Schiff was so brilliant in trying to couch the arguments with regard to impeachment in the words of Alexander Hamilton and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. And that's what we should be talking about. The foreign policy considerations is certainly something we need to debate, but it's secondary to the fact that we have an individual sitting in the White House who's not only compromising American laws and norms, but he's corrupting every aspect of governance that I'm certainly familiar with. And certainly there are issues that could deal with impeachment that aren't being addressed. The Emoluments Clause, for example, with given the decisions that a federal judge in the Maryland area, a man by the name of Peter Massetti, if you look at his decisions, Trump is clearly in violation of the Emoluments Clauses of the Constitution. And then when you go back to Robert Mueller's work that laid out basically the template for how to pursue impeachment on the basis of obstruction of justice. So there are other issues that could have been raised, but I don't think this is a foreign policy debate or a national security debate. I think there's going to be foreign policy consequences, but that's not what this impeachment is about. And again, as others have said, if you can't impeach Donald Trump on the basis of his behavior in the office of the presidency over the past 3 years, then you'll never be able to impeach anyone, no matter what laws are broken in the United States.
Do you think they should have brought other articles other than just this one concerning Ukraine?
Well, there are two. There's one concerning...
You're correct. And obstruction of Congress. That's right.
There should have been one on obstruction of justice and one on emoluments. And if I had any control, there would have been four articles of impeachment. And I think it's kind of ludicrous to argue that they picked those issues where they could get a Democratic consensus or a political consensus. They had to find issues where there was agreement. In the 1980s, we had clearly impeachable issues with the Reagan administration in terms of the deceit and the lies and the failure to observe the law that we referred to as Iran-Contra. But there was no consensus whatsoever. The idea of impeachment was brought up, just as it's been raised with regard to other presidents. But if you don't have support for impeachment, why would you go down that road? Now, with the Ukraine issue, you had a courageous whistleblower from the CIA, an intelligence analyst, who really threw himself in front of a White House, in front of a president, in a very courageous way, and this opened the gates. Not anything that Robert Mueller did over a 2.5-year period that cost $30 million and led to a 400-page report. It was the 7-page memo by this whistleblower. And I don't recall the 2.5 hours that I listened to Adam Schiff, and I thought he was brilliant, but I'm such a huge fan of Adam Schiff and the way he's conducted these proceedings thus far that maybe I'm not the best judge in the world. But there was no mention of the whistleblower. There wouldn't have been testimony from an Army lieutenant colonel or an American ambassador or American Foreign Service officers if there hadn't been the whistleblower, and we shouldn't forget that.
Talk to me, and we'll get back to the impeachment in a moment, Mel. And just to let you know, we're now 5 minutes past the time that the Senate said that it would come back to continue the trial. Frequently, it goes longer than they actually say. But just want to let you know, at a moment's notice, once John Roberts gavels the session back in, we'll have to go back to the Senate floor. But I do want to talk a little bit more about Ukraine. And I'm always hesitant to call it a proxy war, even though it probably has elements of that. But I also want to make sure the people who are there, who you know have their own desires, also have agency for what's going on. Usually when we talk about proxy wars, there are people locally that are fighting one way or the other for something that they want. But what is the United States' interest in Ukraine?
Well, my argument has always been that we don't have national security interest in Ukraine. And the original mistake was made in the Clinton administration with this decision for domestic reasons to expand NATO. So when you start with Bill Clinton's expansion of NATO, which had no national security justification whatsoever, and then George W. Bush weighs in by bringing in former republics of the Soviet Union, the three Baltic states, and then you have Bush even flirting with bringing Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, Putin made it clear there was a red line if we were going to manipulate the political interests of Ukraine and Georgia. And it took a very brave German chancellor to call George Bush and say, George, we're going to be in a permanent Cold War situation with Russia if you continue to move in this direction. And Bush backed off, much to the dismay of Dick Cheney. The Trump administration presents a real quandary for all of us because we really don't know what Trump's policy is toward Russia. We don't know the extent of his relationship with Russia. So it's not a question of conspiracy theories that haven't been proven, but why is Trump so deferential to Putin and Russia? Why is Trump so deferential to the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador? What's the nature of that relationship?
Yeah, Mel, we're going to have to leave it right there. Gerald Nadler has actually taken the floor and the Senate floor to continue oral arguments.
That's Mitch Jezerich. And Mel Goodman was the interviewee, a whistleblower at the CIA. He got out in the time of HW. And the other Gates, not Bill, forgetting the name of the revolving door defense secretary, kept on by Obama, embarrassingly, annoyingly, not unpredictably. Robert Gates, yeah. Goodman and he had a conflict. Well, I mentioned Eric, David Swanson. He's been a longtime activist. He's now with a group called World Beyond War, which is a great idea. This is kind of looping back to, he's one that isn't watching. And I'm going to close out with this short section. They went on to a spirited call-in in the Berkeley area, but we won't be hearing that. Speaking of KPFA again, they're streaming the Answer Coalition demo from out there. I'm not sure when that actually kicks, 2-hour delay and all. The local group Answer and the Iranian Student Association is on board with this no war against Iran. Obviously, there's a lot of conflicted conflict in discourse and in opinions, and you know, these are no mullah fans, obviously. But there's a bunch of different layers of opposition. All agree that cultural sites shouldn't be hit, shouldn't even be threatened. And it is something that's on the back burner now that we have this preoccupation with impeachment. A lot of other things getting short shrift, too, it seems to me. I don't go as far as Mate, but I think his analysis is worth hearing. That's why I put it on, and so is David Swanson's. I'm not sure what's going on the street here. Hopefully, I'll check that out. I hope you're sitting comfortably. Not the best day for a demo, but come on out for a bit. Blow your horn. If you see them walking around on the streets, see me there, too. Hopefully.
Swanson, he's the executive director of World Beyond War. Swanson notes the militaristic policy commonalities between Trump and establishment Democrats. He's very good at that. David Swanson, you've been busy, but you haven't been watching or listening to the hearings. How come?
I've got better things to do, and I think they're a disaster, and I don't think they're the result of a popular movement demanding justice of the powerful. I think they're a palace coup, a corrupt party taking on another corrupt party for its own interests, disregarding dozens of blatant impeachable offenses that are indisputable public acts, publicly bragged about, absolute unprecedented corruption, foreign and domestic, in violation of the emoluments clauses, open incitement of racism and violence, interfering with voting rights, discriminating on the basis of religion, waging illegal wars, threatening illegal nuclear wars, abusing the pardon power, the emergency, declaring emergencies explicitly to violate other laws, illegally tearing up treaties like the INF treaty. So this is the opposite of, you know, getting Al Capone on taxes because you couldn't get him on murder. This is as if you could get Al Capone on murder, it was open and shut. Instead, you chose to go after taxes despite the fact that it was, you know, a dubious case, and you'd have to figure out which witnesses to believe and which ones not to believe, and so on. So it's not an impeachment chosen in order to remove someone from office and put a halt to dangerous and damaging practices. It's a show to score political points, to try to make Trump look bad, as if that was needed, to try to make Biden look good, although, you know, knowing full well that they don't want him to show his face and open his mouth, because that wouldn't make him look good. And it's pushing this Russophobia, this Cold War, this militarism, this notion that you must give weapons, free weapons by the truckload to Ukraine to fight a war created by a coup, created by your government, but you won't mention the coup. You won't mention the horrible people you put in power, the disaster you've created in Ukraine, nor will you even mention the fact that, you know, the Democratic occupant of the White House last, Barack Obama, refused to make it that much worse by giving weapons to Ukraine.
So to sum up, you think the focus of the hearings are a little bit narrow?
Extremely narrow, so narrow as to be misguided, intentionally defeating and promoting horrible militarism and Russophobia that is far worse than the crimes being tried. Here's a president who's corrupted by Saudi Arabia, by Israel, by nations and U.S. states and the U.S. government around the world. Just open corruption, and the idea that some little bit of it might somehow be tangentially tied to Russia, and that's what should enrage me. That idea is more dangerous than any.
What about the notion that, as you say, Trump is a very ugly, he's a walking criminal conspiracy. Get him out however you can. Yeah. Narrow, wide, whatever. However you can get rid of this monster, get rid of him.
Yes, impeach him on Inauguration Day, try him on the second day for indisputable public acts of corruption in violation of the Constitution, and remove him from office on day three. This is what I was advocating for before he came into the White House and have been advocating for ever since, but piling on dozens more indisputable outrages by Trump. And instead, to pick one relatively trivial thing. I mean, you talk about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson as if it had something to do with his racist destruction of Reconstruction. No, they found some trivial
Mitch made that point yesterday when we had him on the air, that this wasn't about the fact that he was a serial, dangerous, violent white supremacist, so on and so forth.
Right, but this is what they've done to us every time. The many impeachment efforts that we never hear about because they didn't make it as far as impeachment or trial, and the ones that we have, including Nixon, including Clinton, these are trivial offenses in comparison with the real outrages, and that doesn't make it easier to get him out of office. It makes it less easy to get him out of office, less easy to persuade the public that you're doing anything that they should have an interest in. Of course, among those people, including myself, who have wanted Trump out of office since before he was in office, anything that would work would be welcome if it didn't do more damage along the way. But this both won't work and will do more damage along
the way. All right, let me jump in here, David, and give out the 800 number, 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008. If you want to try and convince David that he should be more attentive to the hearings, or maybe you agree with him and you think this is a farce and you're furious that somebody like Adam Schiff, who's Mr. Number One recipient of money from defense contractors, who is a 21st century cold warrior, shouldn't be the one leading the charge. 1-800-958-9008. I guess that much must get in your craw, the fact that Schiff is number one defense man.
Well, it's turning this idea that delaying free money for U.S. weapons to a horrible government fighting a destructive and dangerous war that you helped facilitate, that this is somehow defending the United States. I mean, you were absolutely right a little bit ago to say that, you know, or Mitch, maybe it was Mitch who said that it's absurd, the idea that Russia would be fighting Americans in the United States if they weren't fighting them in Ukraine. But Russia wouldn't be fighting that war at all, and we wouldn't be risking a nuclear war between the two big nuclear powers if it were not for disastrous U.S. decisions, including escalating the war with weapons shipments. The people, how many people knew that they were giving their tax dollars for free weapons to Ukraine before it became part of an impeachment drama? Probably fewer than knew that the U.S. was fighting people in Niger before there was a scandal because Trump said something to the wife of a soldier who was killed there. I mean, people have no idea what's going on. How many people managed to know that the House has voted to end the war on Iran and the Senate needs to take up that vote any minute but is too busy with this? You know, how many people are paying attention to the risk of war with Iran, that there are, you know, hundreds of cities around the world planning protests against this coming Saturday? And we're talking about this, you know, spat between, you know, the biggest recipient of war profits on the Democratic side and Donald Trump. How many people noticed that there was approval for the Keystone XL pipeline today? I mean, probably right. Fewer than would have. You know?
All right, let's bring in Bill. I think we have.
Well, we're going to leave Bill out. That was David Swanson. He's the guy that started the Beyond the Memo. What was that memo? It goes way back. His opposition to the Iraq attack was quite insightful and unsuccessful. And as you mentioned, there's 100 cities around the world, I don't know how many in the U.S., that are having demos, including one in Urbana at 1 o'clock on the grounds of, well, just downtown Urbana, starting at the steps of the IMC, the Urbana Post Office, maybe retreating to inside from the inclemency of the weather. Haven't foreshadowed behind the news because I just got it ready for broadcast right now, and I'm not ready for my obligatory rotating underwriting announcement either. It was a limo service having a dispute outside. I don't know. I thought Uber was Uber Allis and Lyft, and I still have limos. Let's see. I'm going to do the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts read here. Web programming is made possible by the Krannert Center for Performing Arts, along with you. They're presenting Still Dreaming, featuring saxophonist, however you want to say it, Joshua Redman. He's with Brian Blade, and